This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 141, The Age of Antiochus. First, a little bit of housekeeping. After some experimentation, I have decided to open the Hopful Media Discord server to subscribers at the $5 tier on hopfulmedia.com.co. This means that $5 now gets you ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and access to a community of other listeners to discuss history of Persia, America's secret wars, and whatever related topics we come up with along the way. Or at least, that's the idea. So head over to hopfulmedia.com.co and sign up today. I will also be presenting once again at this year's Intelligent Speech Conference. It's a great gathering of history and education podcasters presenting on a wide variety of topics centered on the theme of deception. The event is a remote conference that you can access for a week after it ends if you purchase tickets at intelligentspeechonline.com. Festivities will begin at 9 o'clock a.m. Eastern Standard Time on February 8th, 2025. Again, you can go to intelligentspeechonline.com and get your tickets to see presentations from me, our friends at So You Think You Can Rule Persia, Tsar Power, Sword Sorcery and Socialism, and many more, including Robin Pearson from The History of Byzantium, and keynote speeches from Otto English, the Fake History Hunter podcast, and Wesley Livesay of the History of the Great War and History of World War II podcasts. Anyway, today we return to the narrative. We left off with the deaths of Seleucus and Lysimachus as the Seleucid throne passed to King Antiochus I, and Ptolemy Carinaus usurped power in Macedon and Thrace. With those deaths, we officially enter a new period of history. After all of Alexander the Great's old generals had died, and power shifted to their sons and grandsons in new dynasties spanning from Pyrrhus in Italy to Antiochus in Bactria. The Hellenistic world just keeps getting bigger. And frankly, I think you could make a case for including King Ashoka Maurya all the way in eastern India. Unfortunately for me, researching this period is a nightmare. There is no singular big source for the mid-3rd century BCE, or even for any particular events in that time. It's just a succession of references and fragments. So I'll keep referencing the ancient sources I get my information from, but I do apologize if they just blur together into a list of random names. Seleucus was murdered in late 281, and there was immediate chaos. The now sole king, Antiochus, was just about as far away as he could be in the upper satrapies. There, it would have taken months before news of his father's death even reached him. Meanwhile, the Seleucid generals and armies that had accompanied their king to Thrace immediately went to war with the mercenaries and segments of both their own and the Lysimachid army that joined Ptolemy Carinaus. Carinaus had Seleucus's body and held it for ransom, and as news of Seleucus's death spread, pockets of rebellion broke out all over the empire. These revolts were concentrated in Syria and Anatolia. But there is scattered evidence for turmoil all over. Notably, the citadel of Taletakht in Persis was destroyed around this time, likely as part of a Persian revolt that was defeated. One of the consequences of that Persian revolt seems to be that Pasargadae, the ancient palace of Cyrus the Great, was finally abandoned. We don't hear much from the upper satrapies or Babylonia in this time period, but there is a little evidence for some sort of unrest in the city of Babylon itself. In 278, at the end of this tumultuous period, a group of people entered the Esagila complex. That's the temple of the god Marduk that had been in and out of construction since Alexander the Great's death. Our source here is a judicial chronicle, summarizing major crimes against the temple that span almost 30 years. So we don't get much detail, but in this case, it says that Babylonian men and women were joined by the soldiers of someone, the name is lost, and they raided the temple's juniper gardens. This could have been some sort of minor revolt, a mutiny in the Seleucid army, or even a riot that just got out of hand. We don't know. All the tablet says is that the perpetrators were executed with fire. I assume that means something along the lines of burned at the stake, but it could plausibly be much more horrifying. We only know a little more about the Western rebellions. Antiochus would have been scrambling sometime around November of 281 to get as many soldiers, horses, and elephants as he could on the move as he raced across the empire to get revenge for his father's death and deal with the revolts popping up along the way. The historian Memnon of Heraclea Pontica just says that Antiochus recovered his father's kingdom with difficulty, and even then incompletely, through many wars. Some formerly Lysimachid cities in Anatolia that wanted to side with the Seleucids hadn't even had a chance to formalize their support before Seleucus's death. A few, like Miletus, paid lip service by offering Antiochus local titles and ceremonial offices. Others, like the Aeolian Greek city of Pergamon, took a more direct approach. Lysimachus had entrusted Pergamon to one of his chief lieutenants, Philateris, a Paphlagonian Greek eunuch who climbed the ranks through a succession of Diadochoi armies before being given control of a city. During the last war, he betrayed Lysimachus and joined Seleucus. Now seeking favor with Antiochus, Philateris paid Ptolemy Carinaus the ransom to secure Seleucus's body and held a funeral for the late king before sending his ashes onto the Seleucid city of Antioch in Syria. When Antiochus arrived in the region and received those ashes, he ordered a lavish tomb constructed for his father's remains, beginning a grand tradition of entombing the Seleucid monarchs in Antioch. Though he probably wanted more direct vengeance against his father's murderer, Antiochus effectively made peace with Karinaus in 280, almost immediately after realizing just how many rebellions he had to contend with on his side of the Hellespont. There was never any formal declaration of peace, just as there had never really been a formal declaration of war, but Antiochus mostly chose to ignore Karinaus's existence for the time being. Meanwhile, Karinaus and the Antigonid claimant, Antigonus Gonatas, fought a battle at sea as they both raced for Macedon. Karinaus was successful, claimed the throne, and one of his first acts was funding Pyrrhus's expedition against Rome. His half-brother Ptolemy Philadelphus, Antigonus, and Antiochus also funded that expedition because they all wanted Pyrrhus to go very far away. While Antiochus was still busy with the revolts in the east, the large island of Samos rebelled just off the coast of Caria. Weirdly, the leader of this rebellion was a Greek tyrant named Duris, who was better remembered by later authors as a historian than a ruler. In and of itself, having both of those occupations wasn't that strange. Most famously, Ptolemy I wrote a history of Alexander the Great's wars. But it is unusual for a ruler to largely be remembered for his histories. In this case, it is probably because Duris's tenure was quite short-lived. A king came to put Duris in his place, but it wasn't Antiochus. Ptolemy II Philadelphus sailed from Egypt with the most powerful fleet in the Aegean to invade and conquer much of southern Anatolia, while Antiochus was looking in the other direction. Sometimes called the Carian War, or described as part of a quote-unquote Syrian War of Succession, even though there was no other claimant to Seleucus's throne, this attack is sparsely documented, probably because it did not involve much fighting. There were individual cities that resisted, which we know largely because the inscriptions reference how many ships it took to subdue them. However, most just seem to have rolled over and accepted Ptolemaic rule. The recently founded camp city of Seleucia Pieria, on the Cilician border with Syria, even prepared altars and sacrifices for the king of Egypt in advance. And Ptolemy refounded several towns as Arsinoe and Ptolemais, in honor of his mother and father. Remember, this was a region that had been flipping back and forth between new monarchs more than once every 10 years since Alexander invaded, and often it was more frequent than that. The locals didn't really have a stake in any of this anymore, and the Seleucid armies were all in Thrace or Syria or further north. Southern Anatolia didn't have major rebellions, but they weren't about to stick their necks out for Antiochus. So large chunks of Caria, Lycia, Pamphylia, and Cilicia all fell to Ptolemy Philadelphus. Lycia and Pamphylia were, frankly, just connective tissue. They had their own resources and value for sure, but Caria and Cilicia had deep harbors and established shipyards, and Ptolemy I had bequeathed his heir all but unchallenged naval supremacy. Securing southern Anatolia alongside their territories in Egypt, Phoenicia, Cyprus, and the Cyclades quickly turned the eastern Mediterranean into an Egyptian lake. Then Ptolemy Philadelphus moved for a more direct confrontation, with an army going north through Coel Syria while Antiochus was preoccupied further north. There is even less documentation to explain this. In fact, we only even know it happened because Polyaenus references a later battle between Philadelphus and Antiochus in Damascus. Previously, that city had marked the southern edge of Seleucid control, So sometime in the chaotic days of 281 to 279, the Ptolemaic army pushed north and seized the once and future Syrian capital, but they went no further. Ever looking to join whichever side of a war seems to be winning, Miletus started giving honors to Philadelphus just a year after appointing Antiochus as one of their magistrates. Just that city. I swear. I am pretty sure the only time they've remained loyal to their current ruler was for Cyrus the Younger. The modern historian Jonah Lendering interprets this as a sign that the two great kings had some sort of confrontation, which convinced Philadelphus to stand down. But we don't really know any details besides the fact that a strong Ptolemaic garrison occupied Damascus. Another modern scholar, John D. Granger, takes the position that most of the Ptolemaic conquests in nominally Seleucid territory weren't conquered at all. They simply seized on cities and regions that were either unaligned or had existing ties to the Ptolemies. Ultimately, the whole process for Philadelphus's northern expansion is just unclear. Even as Ptolemy Philadelphus swept through his southern territory, Antiochus was dispatching generals to reconquer the petty kingdoms of northern Anatolia. He was potentially overeager to prove himself as king and reconquer all of the fragmented pieces of the kingdom at once. General Diodorus was sent to defeat Mithridates of Pontus, only to be defeated with ease. General Amyntas was sent to retake Cappadocia, only to be defeated and killed when the Cappadocians allied with King Orontes of Armenia to fend off the invasion. Another general, Hermogenes, was sent to the semi-independent cities on the southern coast of the Black Sea in Paphlagonia and Bithynia. One of these, Heraclea Pontica, was trying to secure its own autonomy within the new kingdoms rising and falling around them. So they cut a deal with Hermogenes. Heraclea would support Antiochus if the Seleucid army helped defend Heraclea from King Zapoites in Bithynia. So Hermogenes invaded Bithynia, only to be ambushed and killed by the Bithynian army. If all three of these armies had concentrated on one little kingdom after another, they may have been much more successful, but that was not the strategy that Antiochus adopted. Apparently, the Heracleans saw all of this new state building and wanted to try it for themselves by attacking several of their neighbors, even trying to seize territory in Thrace on the other side of the Black Sea, only to be stopped in their war of expansion by a newly enthroned Ariobarzanes of Pontus. By then, Antiochus had mounted another invasion of these northern principalities to try and seize control of the region himself, this time focusing a single royal army like he probably should have done in the first place. In response, Heraclea, Bithynia, Cappadocia, Pontus, and a scattering of independent Greek cities all joined forces to resist this attack as the Northern League. The League and the Seleucids fought each other to a standstill, and the war expanded when Antigonus Gonatas, currently king of most of Greece, I guess, based in Corinth, began attacking Seleucid forces and supporting the Bithynians directly. Memnon says that this war with Antiochus lasted for a long time, but it's hard to see how that's possible, given that several other accounts have them all making peace within 2 years, and there's no evidence of direct conflict between Antigonus and Antiochus in Europe or even on a battlefield. Instead, the Northern League members were hamstrung at sea from the start because Heraclea had recently loaned its fleet to Ptolemy Carinaus, leaving them entirely reliant on Antigonid aid, except that Antigonus was also at least occasionally fighting with Carinaus. It was a very messy couple of years. Then, when Zapoites died, Antiochus helped to instigate a Bithynian civil war between his sons. As we discussed last time, Nicomedes I of Bithynia will ultimately win here, defeating his Seleucid-backed brother, but seeing all of this turmoil, Pontus effectively withdrew from the league entirely, and Antiochus settled for just leaving his proxies in Bithynia to keep everyone occupied for the time being. All right. That was a lot, and I promise we will slow down at least a little bit. But first, we'll take a break, you'll hear an ad, and we will come back with one of the most famous events in ancient history. Believe it or not, language learning doesn't have to be difficult. You can learn naturally and speak confidently. Rosetta Stone helps you absorb a language the same way you learned your first one, through real-world context and conversation, not memorization. Practical skills you can use right away. The no memorization thing is a big plus to me. I've never been the type of person to pick up language through flipping over flashcards. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert with 30 years of experience, millions of users, and 25 languages offered as the go-to language learning solution. There's no English translations. You just learn to speak, listen, and think in the language you're trying to learn. It's a more intuitive learning process, starting with words, building to phrases, and progressing to sentences. Plus, if you're like me and you're trying to learn a language that uses sounds you're not used to, the built-in True Accent speech recognition feature provides real-time feedback to help you improve those pronunciations. You can also learn anytime and anywhere with a mobile app or on your desktop. And of course, as always, it is an incredible value. You can learn for life with a lifetime membership that gives you access to all 25 languages, so you can learn as many as you want, whenever you want. Don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential now. History of Persia listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Don't miss out. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. All right, just for a moment, let's slow down. We are looking at possibly the most politically chaotic 3 years in history here, and not just because a half dozen monarchs happened to die at the same time. On top of everyone in Syria and the Black Sea trying to sort out a new balance of power, events were unfolding in a part of the world that we've never really talked about on this show before. And these are events that will shake the western side of the Hellenistic world to its core. Either because of natural events or overpopulation, there was a famine far to the northeast in Central Europe. We've never really had a reason to care about this area before, and it will be a long time before I have to mention it again. But during the time period covered by this podcast, there was a lot of change going on up there as a new language and style of art moved around and ran into new peoples from Ireland to Hungary. The Celts. Or, more specifically in our case, the southern branch called Gauls. A century earlier, something happened deeper within the dark heart of Europe to push a wave of barbarian Gauls further south and east. One branch of this migration famously plunged deep into Italy and sacked the city of Rome in 390 BC. while another branch pushed into the Carpathian Basin of modern Hungary. Since then, Gallic raiders had been harassing the Illyrians in modern Croatia and poking around at the periphery of the Greek world. One tribe even sent an emissary to Alexander the Great early in his reign, and attempted a failed raid of Macedon when Cassander was in charge. Well, now, famine hit, sending a much more powerful wave of migrating raiders straight for the Balkans at the worst possible moment. Unless you were a Gaul, and then this was the best luck anybody had ever had. Though this is usually described as a single large movement, the initial sweep into the Balkans broke into three parts, with most of the Gauls invading the relatively weak territories in northern Thrace. As I mentioned last time, one of these invading armies sacked the Odrysian kingdom, destroying their capital city and basically ending the Odrysian dynasty. A third prong of the Gallic invasion in early 279 went for Macedon and killed Ptolemy Carinaus in battle before being driven off by a Macedonian nobleman. Officially, they installed Carinaus's younger full brother as the new king, but that lasted all of 2 months before one of Cassander's nephews resurfaced to seize power. And at the same time, one of Lysimachus's younger sons popped back up to challenge him. So did two other people, for that matter, with the names Alexander and Eridaeus, who may have been the same person and may have been pretending to be somehow related to Alexander the Great. Their story is less clear. From the Greek perspective, this may well have been an alien invasion. And unfortunately, our sources treat it with the same sort of fantastical descriptions previously reserved for only the most terrifying of Persian armies. To hear the ancient Greeks tell it, hundreds of thousands of Gauls poured out of the northern mountains and killed all who stood before them. This is, of course, exaggeration. And the descriptions of Justin, Pausanias, and Memnon rarely agree on the finer details like numbers and what direction any given Gallic army happened to move. But this is the important part. In late 279, a Gallic chieftain named Brennus, not to be confused with the chieftain of the same name who sacked Rome over a century before, invaded Macedon, and just kept going this time, plunging south through the rest of Greece. Unlike most of their neighbors in southern Europe, Gallic military tactics relied heavily on cavalry, even employing 3 riders for every 1 warrior actually engaged in battle. The main warrior would be accompanied by 2 servants who could resupply him with javelins or horses, or alternatively take his place in formation when their master died in combat. Still caught up in the chaos of their own succession crisis, the Macedonian army was all but powerless to stop Brennus's Gauls when they pushed south. Greece was running low on manpower and morale. Of all the regions we visit regularly on this show, central and southern Greece were some of the most exhausted in 279. From the time that Philip II started expanding Macedonian power in the 350s, there had only been about a decade when Macedonian armies weren't at war in Greece. And by the 270s, the Greeks were burnt out. Athens, possibly sensing an opportunity to reclaim some of their polis's old importance, and probably fearing that they didn't actually have the strength to resist if the Gauls made it all the way to Attica, rallied their neighbors. They portrayed Brennus as an even more barbaric Xerxes, come to destroy all of Greece. They also proposed the same plan for dealing with the attack. Assemble at Thermopylae. The Athenians were joined by the Boeotian League, based in Thebes, the Aetolian League, which included most of the cities on the northern side of the Corinthian Gulf, the Locrians, and the city of Megara. On top of Greek allies, Pausanias also references Macedonian and Syrian mercenaries. The Macedonians could really have come from just about anywhere at this point, but given the geography of the situation, they were likely soldiers on loan from Antigonus Gonatas, while the Syrians were almost certainly sent by Antiochus, or at least were there with his permission. Ironically, for a battle of Thermopylae, or maybe not ironically, nobody from the Peloponnese came because the Spartans were threatening to invade somebody's territory given the chance, and did not seem to care who it was. As always, Thermopylae was supposed to be an easy last line of defense. Trying to dissuade Brennus from pushing any further south, Greek cavalry and archers were actually stationed along all of the major river crossings north of the pass. Brennus looked at this and sent a large contingent of his army to make the uncomfortable but undefended crossing through an area where the river turned into a shallow, marshy lake. Pausanias says, "The taller invaders didn't even need to swim." Once they realized that the enemy was past them, the Greeks defending the river retreated, and everyone prepared for a showdown at Thermopylae. The Gauls were slowed down briefly by the defenders of Aetolian Heraclea, but Brennus just had his army move on. This was a raid in force, not a war of conquest. They did not need to take every city. The narrow, rocky pass of Thermopylae served a very similar purpose here to the one it once served against the Persians. The Gallic cavalry couldn't navigate, and the narrow pass between the mountain and the sea created a bottleneck for infantry. So long as the Greeks had a stable phalanx, their Macedonian-style pikes should have made them even more effective against the Gauls than when their ancestors fought the Persians. Since the Gauls were entirely based on land, the Athenian navy was able to sail as close to shore as possible and use their ships as mobile firing platforms for the archers to attack the Gauls as well. After a full day of fighting, Brennus's troops retreated to the northern end of the pass, but their chieftain wasn't giving up. He settled on a strategy of trying to break up the Greek army. He knew from locals that there were contingents from the north with the army at Thermopylae, especially from Aetolia. So Brennus started sending bands of his warriors into Aetolia with instructions to raid and pillage and rape and murder, to cause as much chaos and despondency as possible, and to force the Aetolians to abandon their fellow Greeks. This worked, and was disastrous for both sides. After the Gauls destroyed the city of Caleon and killed most of its inhabitants, the Aetolians returned to their homeland to defend it. Rather than attempt to face the Gauls in a set-piece battle, the Aetolians attacked with a series of brutal skirmishes. This did force the invaders out of their land, but it also left the Aetolian army half-dead in the process. The carnage was also enough for some Aetolians to turn coat and aid the Gauls in exchange for better treatment. And some people from Aetolian Heraclea went to Brennus with an offer near Thermopylae. This is our third or fourth battle here, so I'm sure you know what comes next. These Heracleots told the Gauls, "You know, this pass was actually the site of some very famous battles in our history. There's a, like, goat track that goes around the main road, and we can show it to you." So like many armies before and after, Brennus led his troops up the mountain path, defeated the Phocians stationed there to defend it, and circumvented the Greek defense entirely. The only thing that saved the Greek army in 279 from the fate of the Spartans centuries earlier was that the Phocians had the good sense to send a messenger warning everyone that Brennus was coming. So the Greek army fled before getting completely trapped on both sides. Most of the Greek defenders went home, fearing their own cities would be next, but Brennus had a target in mind. It was probably the reason he was so dead set on Greece in the first place. The Oracle of Apollo at Delphi. By reputation, the richest and most heavily honored temple west of the Euphrates. Unbeknownst to Brennus, that hadn't been the case for some time. The Phocians had plundered the treasury of Delphi during the Third Sacred War almost 100 years ago at this point. And while Delphi was still possibly the most important temple in Greece, it was no longer nearly as wealthy as it tried to present itself. The regions of Phocis, Aetolia, and Amphissa were the local powers with troops available, marshaling only a few thousand Greeks against the invaders. But whether you believe in the old gods or not, nature occasionally throws storytellers a freebie. As the two armies prepared to fight over the most sacred temple in Greece, there was a weak but prolonged earthquake that shook the ground repeatedly throughout the day, which also just so happened to coincide with a raging thunderstorm. Neither of these are uncommon phenomena in this part of Greece, but the two together could only be seen as a divine omen by the defenders, and probably by the Gauls as well. Thunder made it impossible for the Gauls to hear their orders, and they were now a bunch of guys holding spears on horseback in armor on top of a mountain in a thunderstorm. According to Pausanias, bolts of lightning struck inside the Gallic ranks. Absent any scientific understanding, and even with it for that matter, it's not hard to see that as being smote by an angry god. Then, just to drive the point home, it was late autumn, and Pausanias says that the storm kept going even as the temperature dropped, going from rain to snow and frost. Between an earthquake, a storm, and probably a little push from the defenders, boulders tumbled down the mountains and crashed into the Gallic army. When all of that was said and done, the storm eased up around sunrise on the second day, and the Greek defenders charged the bewildered Gauls. Brennus himself was fatally wounded in the battle, and his army was forced into a retreat. Greece just wasn't worth this kind of trouble, and they went all the way back north and fled from Macedon. Between the exhaustion of the Gallic invasion and the succession crises in the north, Antigonus Gonatas seized on this as his opportunity to sail up, unopposed by anyone, really, and claim the kingdom of Macedon for the Antigonid house once again. He was conspicuously absent from the defense of Greece, despite nominally ruling most of it at the time. But why let that slow down your royal ambitions? Seizing and settling affairs in Macedon allowed Gonatas to make peace with Antiochus as well, which was a good thing. Just because Greece, specifically, was no longer being threatened didn't mean that the Gauls were gone. In fact, quite a few of them were still tearing through Thrace in early 278, rapidly approaching the Byzantine Bosporus and the crossing into Seleucid Asia. But that will be a story for next time. Until then, If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.